You are listening to Uncanny Landscapes, Excursions into the Otherwise, with Justin Hopper.
The miners were said to be walking through the moorland, and they got to the cairn, and then they heard a sort of strange howling noise, and so they stopped, and a devil like creature appeared, which they then fought with. We had taken a walk there maybe about a year and a half ago, in the winter, and we'd stopped at quite a high point, and you were like, oh, I can hear it whistling. And you really can, you know, there's this very strange sound that moves through the landscape, and it's quite hard to place. And there is a sense when you move through this that the stones are kind of watching or moving.
Welcome to Uncanny Landscapes, a series of conversations around and excursions into landscapes of the otherwise. Each episode features an interview with a landscape practitioner, someone whose work is rooted in the strange ways we, today, experience our surroundings. I'm your host, Justin Hopper, and you've just heard one of today's guests, Lally Macbeth, who, along with Matthew Shaw, founded Stone Club, talking about the experience of visiting a megalithic stone formation that sings an uncanny song. More from Stone Club very soon. The music you hear is Nine Maidens, an upcoming release by Matthew Shaw. You'll hear more pieces of Matthew's new recordings throughout the show. Subscribe to Uncanny Landscapes on Substack. It's free and includes the podcast, as well as my newsletters of related topics and works in progress. And if you like this work, like and subscribe, and tell a friend, maybe a few. Life is hidden in the stones. That's what I was told years ago by a strange, semi-retired shaman named Mick. I think of it a lot, that life can be revealed through these ancient, human-altered structures, or that stones themselves have life, or perhaps simply that the secret of life is to put a pin in something that's been around the block and return to it from time to time, with fresh eyes and fresh ears. That's what Stone Club does. It brings people together, online, in the post, and in real life, under a simple idea: that which is ancient is here for us all. Folklore, myth, history, they aren't owned by the wealthy or powerful, even if it so often seems that way. That doesn't mean that, for example, a stone circle like Avebury or Stonehenge is an inherently or historically equal thing. What it means is that we now can change the story. We can share in the secret, and through that sharing, overcome. Lally Macbeth and Matthew Shaw started Stone Club as a way for people to get together, get outside, and visit the legend landscape. It's blown up, with thousands of members and many thousands more people keeping an eye out. It's a club both online and in reality, and they operate events that celebrate the legend landscapes of Britain and make music and other cultural productions that help in that endeavor. There's a lot going on. But what really is Stone Club? And what is it for? That's what we're here to find out. And now, here to help, are Lally Macbeth and Matthew Shaw.
Stone Club started back in November 2021. And it was really started as a place for community, sort of people to group together, to come and enthuse about stones, particularly standing stones, but we actually aren't adverse to geological formations or also medieval carving, for instance. And it came out really of a sense of, I suppose, people feeling slightly lost, displaced, post-pandemic, post-lockdown, a real need to reconnect with one another, with the landscape, with place, particularly with your own locality. I mean, we live in a place called Penryn, which is in Cornwall, and here we've got an amazing medieval footprint of a centre of learning called Glasney College, and it was really at one point incredibly famous for producing mystery plays, which are kind of performed throughout the town, but now is almost completely absent. It's entirely lost. There are no really pieces of it left. And so we got had ourselves got really interested.
Sorry, when you say there's no pieces of it left, are you talking physically? I mean, is there right. So it's not just that, oh, it's sort of not really talked about anymore. It's literally gone.
So yeah, physically it is completely gone. It was dissolved during the dissolution of the monasteries. So there are fragments of it throughout the town. And I had got really interested in this and sort of started walking around my town and trying to find these pieces. And I think we generally had a sense that people had sort of started doing this themselves and had got interested in the stone that was local to them or the dolmen that, existed in the field behind their house that they'd never visited. And so I think out of that kind of came a sense that we needed a club, perhaps, where people could congregate and chat about these things and enthuse. And initially that was online only, but somewhere down the line, probably about 6 months in, we thought, oh, actually it'd be really great if we could kind of join together actually physically and do this IRL for people. And that's when it really took off, I think.
Yeah, I think the Glasney example's very interesting because this is just one town and one town's history and something that made it special. And we kind of fi we found the site where these plays were probably made. There was this round enclosure, so we're trying to follow the buildings around where they would be, and we found these fragments of carving which were really incredible, and this kind of m matched and created a pattern in our minds with some of the Neolithic and Bronze Age sites that we're going out and visiting. And what was happening was, I suppose this was a time when people perhaps had been investigating their locality a little bit more. There was only so far you could walk from your front door wherever you happened to be in that enforced period of time of no movement or very little. So the things that were on our doorsteps all of a sudden, it might be like that childhood thing of, I'm bored, and then from boredom becomes a way of thinking about things or investigating them differently because there's nothing else to do. It's like I've walked this same loop 1,000 times. It's so boring. And then it's like, oh, but what's that? There's this fragment I hadn't noticed or considered before. So it can set you off. And it was the same in the landscape when we did start moving around a bit more, finding people at sites that we'd never met, and then sometimes bumping into somebody that we had on numerous occasions, or sometimes even on the same day, you go to four or five places, and someone will be doing a slightly different route, and you bump into them again. And so you have different levels of depth of conversation from first meeting to the end of the day. And by the end of the day, you kind of feel like you know each other really well because you've revealed all kinds of things that you didn't necessarily intend to, just, what brought you there and what was interesting about it, and even what changed through that particular moment in time as well. And that felt really important to share, or to create a forum for people to share. And I think also we were thinking about nature and health and walking a lot as well, mental health as well as physical health, and what kind of things could we do to prompt or encourage movement, walking, being outside of the house again, creating a feeling of sort of safety and safe spaces around that as well. And that seemed to resonate with people. So we asked them, like, send us in your pictures, send us in where you walked, send us in what it was like. And we gave some prompts, like, how was the weather, or who did you go with, or what was in your sandwiches?
Years ago, I met this guy who was he was a bit nuts, to be honest. But one of the things he did as a slightly nuts person was couples counseling, which perhaps isn't, if you met him, you wouldn't think he'd be great at it. But I think he probably was. And one of the things he would always do is take couples that were in trouble out to the stones. This is in Sussex. And make them hug the stones and walk around the stones and all these things. And over the years, whenever I think about it, and I have many times thought about it, like, it does make me think it's a bit of a MacGuffin, really. It's sort of basically saying you need to go do this thing together, and
it sort of doesn't matter what it is, but because we've invested all this lore into this thing. I mean, does that sort of resonate with you as a something that you're working with?
Yeah, it definitely does. I mean, finding something to agree on, that was a big thing. And all, you know, you can't get much more physical than an enormous, you know, 3-ton piece of stone upright in a field. It's quite a statement. You know, this is quite a statement, regardless of what your beliefs are around why it's there. It's quite a statement, and it's not an easy thing to achieve, even now with machinery and so on. So I think there's, you know, that can create a sense of awe, and at least a sense of mystery and wondering around it. So that's a good place to start, because in a way, there's no definitives. There might be archaeological definitives based on now, or there will be geological definitives around what that stone is and where it came from and whether it was moved there, you know, as a glacial deposit or local to the area or revealed through erosion of, you know, soil or whatever. There might even be some theories around use, but then those theories around use will often be over thousands and thousands of years. So you may start with one usage, but then that's probably changed over time. And that's before you get into, like you say, lore or folklore or legend or living memory stories, or even like multi-generational stories in families. And things that might have happened over time. So it's really rich, you know, there's all of those things. And then as people started sending in photographs and reminiscing about things, we hit upon something else, which we called archive, but it was that people would send us in a photograph of themselves, say age 8 or 10, and then them in the exact same spot, age like 30 something, you know, 40 something. And there was something really magical about looking at those two photographs side by side, in one person's life, the stones looking almost exactly the same, the landscape often looking almost exactly the same, and a feeling of being able to sort of travel back through time and reconnect with that previous version of self. And often they also involved traveling to a place where loved ones were no longer alive. So you could stand in that place and you could feel that you were with a parent that you'd lost. Or you could remember a moment in your life that perhaps had sort of like evaporated, mm-hmm. and then come back very vividly as a result of being at that place. So, and you know, this isn't necessarily magic, but it's quite magical to be able to unlock some of those feelings, emotions, sensations. And so that, something that I think we're both really interested in providing a service for, or at least just an invitation.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think with that, what's been really beautiful about that as well is the kind of stories that are happening now as well, because I'm just thinking we had one member who sent us in this beautiful story about her father having died, and having the stone, his favorite stone at Avebury, cast and then recreated in I don't know what material it was, but it was like basically some sort of foam. And then they had this stone present at their wedding, so that he had a kind of place. And so I like the kind of continuation of histories, you know, and narratives through families. And that there was there's also, yeah, just so many examples of kind of children who've been taken to stones as very young children, then gone through to adulthood, and sort of, I think, in childhood and particularly in adolescence, really, really bemoaned the trips, possibly in the rain, possibly feeling quite grumpy and hungry and being dragged around. I mean, I think most people can relate to that. But then finding in adulthood that they go back to that particular site every summer, or, you know, every solstice, and not really knowing why particularly, but, you know, it's this sort of, even within their own lifetime, this sense of being able to return to a place which hasn't really changed. And the feeling that gives you is, you know, it's quite comforting, I think, in a time of deep change and unrest. So I grew up in Ireland, in County Galway, but we used to spend a lot of time going to the Burren, where there were these amazing caves called I called them the Bear Caves. I'm actually not sure of their name, which is quite bad. I probably should look that up. But they, for me as a child, just with the most mystical, amazing spaces. The earliest bear remains were found in these caves, and they just had incredible kind of stalactites everywhere. They were really, I just found them deeply inspiring. So I had this as my sort of early backdrop, and obviously the Burren is littered with kind of standing stones and amazing tombs. And so, you know, we drive through and I'd be kind of looking out of the window, staring at all of this. I then got really, really obsessed with the idea of becoming an archaeologist. So my aunt, dear of her, bought me a young archaeology club membership. And so I'd obsessively read the magazine in bed as a kid. And there were quite a few photos of me just falling asleep with, you know, with this magazine sort of draped over me. And my dream was that, you know, I would be able to go on a dig. But because I was at that point living in Cornwall, there were none near me, and so I'd sort of constantly moan at my mum that she had to drive me to wherever one was happening, and she'd be like, that's never happening. So I then sort of, I guess I moved away from it in a way for quite a long period of time, but I was living in Cornwall, so we did sort of go on walks, and my mum was always really really interested in landscape. She's an artist, and so sort of would drag me out looking at things. But I wasn't fascinated by it myself at that point. And then I guess, you know, I went away to university, sort of lived away for quite a long period of time, and then gradually found myself getting more interested again, partly probably from a sense of nostalgia almost for this landscape that I'd, you know, been immersed in as a child, and really wanting to try and think about that again. So I started making work about it and coming back home and sort of exploring Cornwall more, and spent a lot of time in West Penwith making work there, and particularly responding to the landscape in terms of an artist called Aethel Cahoon, who I got really obsessed with, and was sort of recreating her automatic methods that she used in the landscape. So sort of automatic drawing and scrying and frottage and all sorts of strange and wonderful things. And then from there, I guess I just got really, I got really interested in it again. And it's sort of funny, I think, how these things come back around, because I think, you know, the two things I really wanted to be as a child were a postwoman and an archaeologist. And now I have literally combined the two with Stone Club. So yeah, I think that's it really. And I can't really imagine why I ever turned away from it. But in a way, I think it is quite a helpful thing when you have, because it makes you all the more fascinated in adulthood. The postwoman bit comes in that I send out memberships. So I am the person responsible for writing all the membership cards and handwriting the envelopes and taking them to our very lovely postman, who doesn't ever complain, despite the fact that I'm like, I've got quite a few for you today. But I quite enjoy it, actually. It's very meditative, writing all of the membership cards. And I never thought that we would still be doing it all by hand, but I really like that we do.
Well, definitely the first stones that really captured my imagination were the ancient crosses in Sandbach, or the Saxon crosses, as they were sometimes called. They used to be those sort of very old Ministry of Works signs with an arrow saying "to the ancient crosses," which I really liked. And they were just very odd, you know, in a way. There's a cobbled centre to Sandbach, which is the old market square, and the Saxon...
Can you just tell us where this is?
Oh, yeah. So this is Sandbach in Cheshire. It's in the northwest of England. It's a small market town in Cheshire. There are many of them. And the centre of the town, the market square, is this cobbled square. There are two things in there. There's a war memorial and there's the Saxon crosses, which at some point had been broken up and displaced and moved away and then put back together again as a project years later. And there are still fragments outside St. Mary's Church. And they were just always there. So in one way, they were very normal. But then as I was growing up, I realized that not every town had those in the center of town, and not every church had strange sort of haunted, ghostly faces that would stare out of fragments of stone by the porch. And although they were historically interesting, I suppose, and archaeologically interesting, it was a really interesting combination of things for me, you know, coming out of, I don't know, church after a service or something, or walking around there slightly older as a teenager, bored, and seeing these things sit there that seem to be so alive and odd and incongruous in that setting. So I think that was something that was really central, you know, to my earliest memories, this place that had that, and how that perhaps made that town different than some of the ones surrounding it. And at school, at a really early age, I suppose, probably junior school, we'd have read Alan Garner's books, because he was like the local author in Cheshire. So The Weird Stone of Brisingamen and Alderley Edge would be the place it was set, would be a very common Sunday afternoon walk with grandparents, you know. So you would see things like the wizard carving and know that it was in the book, and realize that one was an act of fiction, a work of fiction, but what it would do is it would set my own imagination going. So there was his version of what that was, but then it was like a unlocking a door to imagination in terms of physical real things in life and these imaginings of what they could be or what they might be. And so that was really present as a child. And then it was probably about 20 years later that I really started to become obsessed, I suppose, is the word in ancient sites, on moving to Dorset. I didn't really know the place very well outside of the towns and a recording studio that I was working in at the time. But I bought a car, and a really old car that was very bad. It had to be sort of pushed to be started, but it would get me to these sites and generally get me back. And it was such a good way of connecting up all of these different towns in Dorset. And I think the Nine Stones in Winterbourne Abbas was the first one I went to. I bought a copy of The Modern Antiquarian by Julian Cope. I'd read all the essays. I'd been a fan for ages anyway, and had these postcards delivered as part of his mailing list. I think it was called CAC at the time. It was like, you know, CAC Enterprises, or maybe it was even Gog Magog Publishing. But there was these interesting postcards. I suppose their real purpose was to give news of a new record or tour. But the pictures were always of the Menantal or in Lanyon Quoit or something that Julian had been visiting, writing The Modern Antiquarian. So I suppose the function of them was to sell a record or sell a ticket, but what they really did was make me marvel about these places and want to go and visit them. So the Nine Stones of Winterbourne Abbas, it's right by Main Road. It's very unglamorous in some ways, because you've got all these trucks hurtling past. It's very dangerous to try and cross. But once in the enclosure of it all, somehow all of that sort of dissolves away, and there's a feeling of something else. And I found that really interesting, being at that place, and then trying to find the lesser known or harder to find places became like a game. So, you know, you'd have like at this time an Ordnance Survey map that was either flapping around in the wind or getting soaked or just, you know, really out of control. Just like, where am I? I think I'm in this field, but I could be in that one. And I think I need to follow this perimeter, and I hope the farmer's not here. And, you know, just trying to find my way around, sort of getting to grips with access to the countryside and trying to find places. And it sort of just built up. And through that, there was an online aspect too, because the forums on The Modern Antiquarian were full of other obsessives that would give all of the hints and tips, you know, about how to get there or where to park or the best access or the name of the man or woman, you'd have to phone to get the key to get through the gate to the place, or the pub maybe nearby. But everyone was really helpful and it felt like a real community. And that started to manifest in people meeting each year at Avebury. So I'd meet people in real life, or I'd meet people at Julian Cope gigs, because somehow there was this combination of people that were really interested in music and antiquarian sites and all of the things that connected around that, which could be incredibly political too. It could be road protesters. It could be people that just really liked Amandul 2 or Cannes or Kraftwerk, or it could be people that were really amazing at knowing things about these ancient sites. You know, they'd come to it from that direction and they didn't really know why somebody was listening to whatever the record of the month was that month.
I really like the idea that I love these people who Steve Davis is the other one that comes to mind. Like Julian Cope is the kind of person for whom lots of people would be like, wait, you mean you make music? You know, like he's just got two complete worlds that he's immersed in and is this figurehead to, and there are places where they maybe don't cross. I love those kind of folks. And you were talking about Julian Cope, the I don't know what we'll call him, pop singer, I guess, at worst. Pop singer who also wrote this book, The Modern Antiquarian, which was around, I don't even know when that was. Is that in the 90s?
Yeah, I would have bought it in the late 90s and started sort of probably just reading things on the website in the late 90s and then got more involved. And many of those people that I met at that time are still really good friends. You know, they became really, really good friends. And one in particular actually makes films for Stone Club every month, pretty much, whenever we do it at the social. Spaceship Mark Williamson. He was on the forum and really active at the time, and he was in bands and making music, really different to what he's doing now. And there's many people like that where they would just, you know, they'd sort of drop in on a forum and say, has anyone heard this? Or if you send me a self-addressed envelope, I'll send you this bootleg. Or if you send me the stamped addressed envelope, I'll send you this William Stukeley article that I managed to find, which is really, really cool. So, you know, it was kind of like a black market of Julian Cope bootlegs and antiquarian prints.
So in a way, that must be a, you know, those forums? I don't even know. But anyway, those online presence must be the direct antecedent of what you're doing.
Yeah, it was definitely a huge part. And we didn't want to replicate it exactly. You know, the intention wasn't to set something up that did the exact same thing, but there's elements of what were there that I thought were really, really, really important to me. You know, making friends in that way and feeling part of a community of people, being really interested and inspired creatively, and you know, all of that combined was really powerful, is still. And so we chose our own sort of way of putting that across. It's true to say that we were having a lot of fun with the idea of memberships initially. It was very much based, we've said this before, but it was very much based on the Dennis the Menace fan club, where you would get a badge and a secret wallet full of like jokes or codes you could say to other members and they'd know, like, you know, a sort of a Beano Masonic order. So we thought that would be really fun, that, you know, you could spot somebody by their badge, or, you know, and they'd have their membership card, membership number, and then members can contribute. So rather than it just being an open forum website that everyone can contribute to, which I love, you know, the Megalithic portal does that incredibly well, user generated articles and photographs and sharing. We thought, well, we'll do something that's like the middle pages of the Beano, where someone draws a picture of Minnie the Minx and sends it in and we publish it. So it's a bit more like that. It's a bit more, it's not comic, but it's sort of like, well, if you join the club, you can share things and we'll make that open and accessible. And then you can meet up with other members in your area. You can sort of self-organize to a degree. And that you know, that was the hope, and then it happened. So it did work that way.
We really felt we wanted it to look a bit homemade and sort of, yeah, I think there is, I mean, I love, there are lots of things which are really slick and beautiful. And I'm absolutely with you. Like, I think, you know, graphic designers do a brilliant job. I am not a graphic designer. And there was no point really in us trying to pretend that we were. So if, and I think there's something also about the kind of immediacy of that kind of photocopied flyer, which is really, really appealing. Particularly when you're trying to get someone to come to an event. I don't know, I'm always really drawn to handwritten notes on the back of doors, or sort of, you know, when you go into the shop and there's all those like notice boards with the kind of like rent this room. Or we were really interested in kind of early zine culture as well, weren't we, in terms of like the back pages of the zines where they had, you know, the list of all the other things that you could buy, or rooms that you could rent, or like a car that you could buy, or... really like, and quite random things. I mean, we read a brilliant one the other day, didn't we, about like macrobiotic seeds that you could buy from this man, and you just have to send him an envelope with a stamp on the back. But I think that whole sort of culture and the kind of community around that world was really, really what we were trying to tap into, because I think there were lots, you know, there were obviously lots of people doing not similar things, but kind of creating communities online. And I think we really wanted an emphasis on the real world and meeting and being in each other's presence and creating community that way as well, and the two could feed into one another. And I think, you know, having that kind of quite homemade aesthetic really, really seems to feed in well to that.
Well, and it's true that it also is that, so you know, it might look that way, but it really is. There's no secret team of people helping or putting things together, and the curation of these things is exactly the same as putting on music nights, you know, or choosing DJs to DJ next to each other. It's kind of one part like DIY, you know, punk or indie gig situation, where it's like, who have you seen recently that's good, you know, that would fit well with what other band or thing. So, you know, we just happened to, we made the decision that that would be across different mediums. So you would have an author talking about a book. You might have a band. Sometimes it can be both. You might have DJs or live bands, and there might be films, you know, so it would be across all kinds of different media, but it really is like what you're into, you know, and it's conversations about what things are really exciting and what things are coming up, and who do we know that's doing stuff out there in the scene, and wanting to curate that and put it together as something that we really want to see. So the night will always be some sort of combination of things that seem to make sense. And the flyers are literally put together in that way, just exactly the same as I was doing, you know, in the 90s, you know, or Lally would have been doing. It's like, okay, we've got these five things. We need to stick it on an A3 poster. You know, what pictures have you got, you know, and it's like, it's really put together that way, and they're done really quickly, often with the same energy that gigs would be put together. We need to get this out, we need to get it listed, and it would be very much in the same aesthetic as any kind of DIY gig or rave or event. It's totally that, isn't it?
There is this, you know, you mentioned a couple of times sort of like the scene or ideas like that. And there is this resurgence of interest in sort of ancient and legend landscapes in Europe and Britain in particular in recent years. And that sort of happens on what I would consider an almost semi-regular schedule. You know, like in the 90s, there was this. And in the early 2000s, there was this. And now in the 2020s, there is this. coming at it from slightly different angles, but this same sort of latching on to these things. And I wonder if you have any thoughts as to why this is sort of something that people are latching on to right now. You know, there's so much in our culture around these subjects, and what you do has become really popular, and everyone wants to join up. Can you, what is it, what's happening in Britain in particular that compels us to look outside and look backwards in a way?
Well, I think in one way, it's in relation to the state of the affairs of the country. So in one way, it has to be not necessarily escapism, but an alternative to what we're living through. You know, Britain's been a very divided, well, probably always has been a very divided place, despite, you know, people that would like to think otherwise. There's always been more than one point of view about what it is, or right the way through, particularly if you start looking at land and land use, and you start looking at ownership, and you look at how that works and those inequalities. I think there's also there's always the magic of the landscape and places. There's always those hidden things, like we talked about at the beginning with Glasney College and Penryn, or the Saxon Crosses and Sandbach, or the place that's in your town or village or countryside near you, that they've always been there. And I think probably it's just a natural cycle of people get really interested in all that, so that's all you hear about. And then it just, you know, as a result, people are like, oh God, not that again. You know, I'm fed up of hearing about those crosses. You know, I just want to do something else. So it's sort of, you know, it sort of ebbs and wanes, and, you know, and it changes over time. But I think at the moment there's a great need for reconnecting with place. I think there's a lot of questions around identity, and what makes us us, and what makes us us in relation to other people. And I think there's some really amazing opportunities in that conversation around thinking, first of all, about that, and then acting out of a position that feels like the right thing to do, which is down to each individual. And I think for us, it's very clear that we're interested in Stone Club being for everyone. We made it a rule, and a very serious rule, although the rules, we sort of put them together again, just in the same DIY, very quick way. And it involves snacks and coats as well as it being all inclusive. But the all-inclusive thing is really important, because the opportunity to meet in a place where nobody has the upper hand and nobody's an underdog, and to be able to have a conversation that's purely about deciding to go to that same place at the same time, even if you didn't know you were going to, and meeting somebody on completely equal terms feels like a really, really powerful opportunity. Because if you're open to that, you can meet the person, you can find them on those terms, and you can find points of agreement. You've already got one that you decided that place was the place to go to. And so if that's a starting point for agreement and a starting point for finding out about somebody else and conversing, then I think that's really beautiful. And if that can then lead on to finding other things to agree on, and even things to disagree on, but with respect, you know, like, okay, I think that person might have had really different views than me politically on that subject, but actually there was a lot more to the person than that. So we're moving away from binary positions, and we're moving away from being fixed on what we think is right or wrong. And we're moving into a more interesting space for me, which is this is a space where anything could happen. We could actually make friends with people that we felt would be completely other, or even somebody that you wouldn't want to spend time with previously. So I really love that idea. So anyway, at the moment, I feel like that's an opportunity. I don't know why particularly people are so enthusiastic about that, but I think that must be part of it, an opportunity, whether it's conscious or not.
No, I think that's definitely part of it. I would also say that I think sort of growing climate anxiety and climate catastrophe has a bit to play in terms of people getting re-engaged in the landscape, and sort of there's a sense within certainly within the Stone Club community, but also other communities like the Megalithic Portal, that there's a real need to reconnect and kind of learn about these places and protect them to some degree, but also respect them. And I think that even unconsciously with certain people, I really notice there's just a sort of an urgency in the interest, which I think has maybe not been quite so present in previous movements.
I always think of ruins that they're, you know, and I think of stone, these kinds of formations as ruins, but I always think they remind people that the way things are now isn't the way they've always been, and therefore the way things are now is not the way they will always be. And it does kind of, you know, to excuse the pun, but I keep thinking, how can I say this without saying blank slate? But the stones do provide a kind of blank slate, don't they? Where you can go and everybody's got their story and they're all right. You know, they're all true. They're all equally true and equally mythological. And it does let you kind of think, you know, it does let you create stories about the way things were and about the way things are, therefore, and therefore about the way things might be. Does either of you have a sort of favorite legend, a favorite piece of lore about one of these locations that you're particularly interested in?
In West Hemwith, there are several sites, mainly stone circles, but also cairns as well, which record kind of dancing legends, or, you know, maidens being turned to stone on the Sabbath, which in itself is an interesting idea, them being much older than the Sabbath. But I wrote a piece maybe last year, which we then turned into a film, and we showed at a couple of stone clubs, which kind of recorded these different legends. And a particular favourite was a site which sits just above Tregaseel stone circle called Carn Cnidjac, which is a brilliant Cornish word, which it translates as the hooting cairn or the howling cairn, doesn't it? And the legend is that there were a group of miners, because it's a very sort of, I suppose, interrupted landscape, in that it's had all of this kind of prehistory, but then also moved right through industrial history and is really, really quite altered, which I'm also always really aware of when I'm walking through it. So it's naturally a very haunted and quite odd place. But the miners were said to be walking through the moorland, and they got to the cairn, and then they heard a sort of strange howling noise, and so they stopped. And a devil-like creature appeared, which they then fought with. And they, I think they win, don't they? And then it sort of disappears into the landscape. But we had taken a walk there maybe about a year and a half ago, in the winter, and we'd stopped at quite a high point, and you were like, oh, I can hear it whistling. And you really can, you know, that there's this very strange sound that moves through the landscape, and it's quite hard to place. And there is a sense when you move through this that the stones are kind of watching or moving with you, because it's very easy to get pisky led and sort of find yourself in a place where you're like, oh gosh, I thought that was there, but it's now there. And I really love the way that Cornish folklore or legend kind of records this feeling, which is actually very present when you're walking through. So yeah, for me, it's all about the dancing or moving stones and the howling ones.
That music idea, I mean, that was such a strange phenomenon, hearing that sound, because it's unlike anything else. It sounds like it's sort of coming, it's very elemental. It feels like it's perhaps coming out of the ground rather than being played. But it's also a little bit like a flute or a wind instrument. You know, it's been played. It's a natural occurrence. And it's incredible. You know, I tried to capture it. It's so difficult to do so. But I think that sound in relation to sights is something really fascinating. You know, that's, you were saying before about the cycles of time, and even, you know, in my own life so far, there's been several of these cycles of working creatively with, you know, with friends or meeting friends who are working creatively with these places. I suppose that there was a great interest around site-specific recordings, field recording, probably 20 years or so ago. You know, lots of people were doing that, and that fed in to the same aesthetic we were talking about with the posters and flyers of this very DIY culture. You would press up a CDR, or you'd like make 50 of them and you'd hand draw the covers, or you'd create a cover and wrap it around and then share it with a community of people that would be open to wanting to hear that and to share them or to trade them. And I think it's very similar now. What I really love about what's happened with Stone Club, and it started on the very first night when Dr. Ben Pitcher came up at the end and said, I've got this book I'm writing. Maybe I could give a talk later Stone Club. And then like six later, he came to do this talk about stone circles as non-fascist spaces, you know, and he had this amazing book published around the same time. But what that's just one example. What I love is that there's all kinds of things bubbling up and coming out. There's record labels, there's bands, there's solo projects, there's collaborations. And I think the legends play a big part in that. I think the sites themselves play a big part in that. And the sort of excitement and fascination that starts to come with a scene. So I think that's like something about the creativity of all of that that is really, really exciting. And I love it every week, you know, every day there's something new and I'm like, oh, that looks really interesting. We'll have to check that out, you know, and we'll try and book that for a future Stone Club thing. So it's interesting that keeps coming back, the dancing. There was a really interesting thing that happened with the Gurdy Stone placing and day that we were involved in recently. The Gurdy Stone is a 3-ton, I think, piece of Welsh slate that was found and then brought to East Sussex, Kingston near Lewes, by Jimmy Courty and Jem Finer, to artists and musicians. And they had the stone placed in the Sussex landscape and then invited some friends to come for that day. And then a week or so later, there was an event to celebrate that and the encoding of that stone. And the day began with a maypole. It's interesting, it ended with a standing stone, but it began with a maypole and the children of the village and the surrounding area dancing around a maypole. And that legend that Lally just talked about with the, you know, the maidens dancing on the Sabbath around, there's such a strong connection there between you know, that folk custom of the maypole and the standing stone later on, when the Bald Knobbers, the musicians that were playing, also circled around the stone playing their instruments, like the pipers that are often connected with the stone circles in legends. And a friend, Al, brought a drone and filmed both of those happenings. And there's a really odd phenomenon that happens in the center of the maypole from above when the drone looks down on it, and it's like all the flowers wake up and awaken just within the circle. It's very odd. It may just be a technical thing, but it's really odd the way in which these people circling, you know, children, moms, different people that are there in the community, mostly is what was happening. But it seemed to really create a field of energy that was really hard to explain, and kind of, you know, it's easier to say, oh, it's just a glitch in the camera, than it is to accept the fact that it might have really been creating something. But when you look at that, and when you look at the inspiration and the projects that are coming out, it's fascinating. You know, there has to be some reason why, beyond just capturing our imaginations or the visual aesthetic that so many people are drawn to create. So it's less one piece of folklore for me, and it's more that's another element of inspiring creativity. Music's what I've been making forever, really. You know, I got interested in music at about the age of 10, and since then I've always been trying to make some sort of noise, and sometimes quite literally just releasing CDRs of noise. But one aspect of what's happening around Stone Club are projects around that. So there's a few things going on. One is we've started remixing a lot of other artists and sort of bringing what a Stone Club version of something might sound like. Because we've been DJing out a lot since Gweno invited us out as her tour support DJing, you know, so we would make films of Stones and then we would play music that we would pick up along the way and that started off thematically around Stones, but ended up wherever, you know, whatever we'd found in a charity shop. So Stone Club remixing things is really interesting. And the first thing is the Gurdy Stone, the Hurdy Gurdy song. I talked about the Gurdy Stone, but the Hurdy Gurdy song, it's been released on vinyl later this year and it's on digital now. So we did the 23 minute mix, including the shaman investing the stone into the ground and doing his magic. So it's a combination of that. As well as that, the Pillars of Wonder. Pillars of Wonder was an idea that came out of Richard Norris and I working in a studio in Lewis. We decided to make an ambient record, and on the first day we'd recorded that. So on the second day we decided we'd do something else, and we sort of accidentally hit upon a very cinematic sounding sort of pop song. But because it's Richard and I, we also thought, well, it should have magical and ceremonial aspects. So we've been doing these processions where we've had artwork by Jamie Reed, and we've been having these amazing statements about love and about fuck your wars and about, you know, connecting people together. So it's kind of like on one hand all encompassing and beautiful, and on the other hand it's very political and anti-war. And people have started writing lyrics for that, you know, and contributing and guest vocalists. So that's a project. And then we got really into buying these Moog LPs from charity shops, you know, like for a quid, you'd get this and it'd be like, you know, 10 tracks, there'd be two amazing pieces of music that you could DJ. And then there'd be like nine that are just like great, but not the sort of thing you could necessarily DJ out. And we were like, oh, we should just make a Moog record. So we did that recently too. And just fun things, fun musical projects where we're, interpreting our own experiences of sites through that. And then there's the Folk Archive as well.
Mm. Yeah, and the Folk Archive is, I mean, I started it on Instagram like maybe 2 years before Stone Club started up. But it really comes out like of a lifetime of interest in folk and folklore, but particularly kind of objects. So I was originally a fashion historian, really immersed in sort of archives, and had an intense frustration with the internet and the lack of labelling on objects. So it was quite a nerdy pursuit in its first instance, because I was just kind of trying to remedy bad labelling. But also it sort of came out of I was making a lot of work about kind of folk costumes and objects, and really wanting a place to just put images that I wasn't using, and thinking, oh, these are really amazing, but maybe someone else might, you know, might find them interesting or inspiring in some way. So it sort of grew out of that. And in the last sort of 2 years, it's really taken over in a really positive way. I mean, I absolutely love doing it, and I'm about to embark on probably my biggest project with it yet, because I'm writing my first book, which is really exciting and scary in equal measure. I think it really, I'm always of the belief that it's really important to myself that the kind of projects feed into one another. And I think with Stone Club, it doesn't feel like such a leap from the Folk Archive, in that, you know, we sort of explore folklore through Stone Club.
Thank you for listening to Uncanny Landscapes. We'll be back soon with the next installment. My guests have been Stone Club founders Lally Macbeth and Matthew Shaw. They have events coming up in Cornwall and London, with a lot more to be announced, and records and books coming up as well. Check out their website at stoneclub.rocks. That's one word, stoneclub.rocks. The music is by Matthew Shaw from upcoming Stone Club-related releases, including their Megalithic Moog project. His website is matthewshaw.org. The title theme is by the Bellbury Poly, and the Uncanny Landscapes icon is by Stefan Musgrove. I'm Justin Hopper. Follow me on Instagram at @oldweirdalbion, and subscribe to this podcast's cousin Substack, helpfully also called Uncanny Landscapes. And don't forget to like and subscribe to everything. Finally, all the links I've just mentioned are on the Uncanny Landscapes site, uncannylandscapes.podbean.com. More installments coming soon. If you've enjoyed this and other episodes, please subscribe to the Substack. Like, rate, and share the podcast, or just tell a like-minded friend or two. And until next time, I leave you with the words of the late anthropologist Marc Auger. One day, perhaps, there will be a sign of intelligent life on another world. Then, through an effect of solidarity whose mechanisms the ethnologist has studied on a small scale, the whole terrestrial space will become a single place. Being from Earth will signify something. In the meantime, though, it is far from certain that threats to the environment are sufficient to produce the same effect. The community of human destinies is experienced in the anonymity of non-place and in solitude. So there will soon be a need, perhaps there already is a need, for something that may seem a contradiction in terms, an ethnology of solitude.